Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, and I'll be hosting today's show as usual. Yes to Life is the UK's integrative cancer care charity, helping people with cancer to find out what they can do to help themselves. It's the charity that the show is named after, and that provides the focus for the guests and topics in every episode. The topic this week is one that's getting increasing attention and one I find fascinating. It's come up from time to time in discussions on the show, but this is the first time I've devoted a whole episode to it. Psychedelic drugs. To talk about the growing understanding and science in this field, I'm speaking over the internet to Joan Neal, an expert in pharmacology and mental health, and Rachel Dando, a researcher working with Joe on a study of psilocybin use amongst those with cancer. Hi Joe and Rachel, a warm welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's really great to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Wonderful. So today we're going to be talking in some depth about a topic that often gets referred to in the Yes to Life show, but this is a first in terms of actually focusing on it exclusively, psychedelics as therapy. And of course, in the context of this show, psychedelics as an integrative cancer therapy. So in medical circles, it's known as psychedelic assisted therapy, I understand. So Joe, I wonder if you'd start out by explaining exactly what it is.
Thank you for that, Robin. Yes, that's a very good question. So what we're talking about here are psychedelic medicines, and most of these come from plants. And the specific psychedelic we're talking about today is psilocybin. So that is the active ingredient of magic mushrooms. And I suspect that a lot of your listeners will have heard about psilocybin because there's been a lot of recent research in the last 15 years, especially at the Imperial Centre for Psychedelic Research, on the use of psilocybin and, of course, other psychedelics to treat very hard to treat mental health disorders. And this is for patients really who are treatment resistant, where talking therapy, the current antidepressant therapy doesn't work. So there have been some very recent successes for treatment resistant depression, for PTSD, so for trauma in combat veterans. And that's really an aspect of the therapy that kind of I'll focus on today. So this is about using psychedelic medicine. And I should say a few things about psychedelics, actually, maybe before I launch into the actual treatment and how this relates to cancer-related distress and how it may help people who are listening to this and practitioners. So this is very much in conjunction with therapy. So it's one or two high doses of the psilocybin and in conjunction with a lot of therapy afterwards and a lot of preparation beforehand. So we talk about set and setting. So the person has to be in the right mindset to receive this medicine, and it's kind of about receiving the plant. And they have to be helped to make sense of that experience afterwards. Because as I'm sure your listeners will understand, it is a very intense psychological experience. We talk about an altered state of consciousness, a dissolution of the ego, and very much making the person feel less interested in themselves, less connected to themselves, and much more connected to the universe and nature, and very much a connectedness to the environment and the planet. So that therapy has proven to be very successful for people with severe depression who do not respond to anything else, for people with trauma, for addictions. And of course, these are plant medicines that grow in the Amazon, that are naturally found. Psilocybin mushrooms are naturally found here in the UK and many other countries. So these are medicines that indigenous people have used for thousands of years and have recognized their spiritual value and also their healing properties. We all know that many plants have have significant healing properties. And of course, many drugs are based, you know, come from plants that we use today, aspirin, willow bark, and so on. But in terms of the therapy for cancer-related distress, there was a lot of work done on this in the 50s and 60s in the States, because of course Hoffman synthesized LSD in the laboratory, and he was working for Sandoz, the pharmaceutical company. And this, it wasn't illegal in those days, and they recognized that this was a very important molecule and had very significant effects on brain and behavior, but they didn't really know exactly what. So they distributed free to any scientists, psychotherapists who were interested in exploring it. So at that time, there was a lot of research done on the existential anxiety and depression that occurs when people get a life-threatening diagnosis or have had a life-threatening event, with great success. So the kind of the result, and it's not treating the illness itself, but it's treating the distress and the symptoms that come along with that illness that disables people in living the best possible life that they can. And what they found, even in those days, in the 50s and the 60s, was that psychedelic therapy enabled people. It massively reduced their depression and their anxiety. They became much more accepting of, I suppose, the having a diagnosis and the transition to whatever phase was coming next, and less sort of really taking away the fear. And of course, all that research was shut down in the 1970s because of the Nixon administration. And psychedelics were put into Schedule 1 of the UN Convention, and they were made Class A drugs. So they were made illegal, and they were put in such a position within the law that makes them extremely difficult to research them. And that's actually still the case today. So organizations like Drug Science, and I work for the University of Manchester, we're all working hard to try and at least reschedule psilocybin so that we can do our research more easily. Even though we have this problem with the law, it is possible to do research with psychedelics if the institution applies for a special license, but that's very slow and bureaucratic and so on. However, we have still managed to perform a number of studies recently, and these are reasonably large scale clinical trials. And I would say that there are more and more places engaging in this research now. Harvard, Johns Hopkins in the States, Imperial King's, Manchester, UCL in the UK. And there have been some new trials conducted with cancer patients. And again, now we have much more sophisticated technology. So again, what we have shown is very significant effects to reduce anxiety and depression that comes with a cancer diagnosis, and that these effects are very long lasting. And a study has just come out in severely depressed patients on looking at how they impact the brain, because of course we didn't have imaging studies and sophisticated EEG in the 60s and 70s. And now we have a much better understanding of how these drugs produce their effects in the brain, which is, of course, important for the scientists and developing new medicines. But I think for your readers, the main issue, or the main sort of message, is that there is now a lot of evidence from the previous pre-1971 studies and post, you know, 1990, 2000, 2010s up to 2020, there have been a lot more studies. And again, the results are extremely encouraging that this can transform patients' lives and enable them to live in a much better, much more hopeful, optimistic way.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, one thing that's very striking from what you said is actually they already knew this in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, you know, more than half a century ago. And yet a quick change in the law and that benefit is axed from being accessible to patients, which is tragic, really. Don't think of the amount of suffering that could have been saved if a more pragmatic view had been taken at that point. Okay, so you're both part of an initiative to demonstrate useful function for psilocybin in the field of mental health. Can you just briefly tell us what your background is, both of you, and what's led up to your involvement in the arena of psychedelics?
So my background isn't at all really psychedelics or drug related. So I'm currently doing a forensic psychology master's at the University of Manchester. And previously I worked with vulnerable individuals in a role called an intermediary. So that's where I support or facilitate communication between vulnerable individuals who are involved in criminal or family proceedings, either as a defendant, a witness or a victim. And I also worked as a investigative interviewer. So I specialised in interviewing children with additional needs who had been victims or witnesses of crime. I previously to this master's, I did a master's in psychology of conversion because my undergraduate was not linked to anything remotely to do with psychology. So I've come into this through my forensic psychology master's. I was asked to be part of this piece of research, I think probably because of my experience of interviewing vulnerable people. About quite difficult events, really. So yeah, I was asked to do it by my supervisor, Dr. Verity Wainwright, and here we are.
Fantastic. Okay, and Jo?
So, Robin, I'm a professor of psychopharmacology at the University of Manchester, and I have spent my whole career trying to develop better treatments for serious mental illness. Even as an undergraduate, I did a pharmacology degree and did a year in industry. So for anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, addictions, very keen to work on addictions. And I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry, but mostly in academia. And we've worked on very early stage drug discovery. So within academia, I've worked with most of the big pharmaceutical companies looking for better treatments for psychiatry. And about 15 years ago, Big Pharma pulled out of this area completely. People like Roche, Lilly, GSK, because there have been some spectacular failures in phase three trials, which can cost up to, you know, these are these very large multi-center right. trials that can cost up to $1 billion. So that, you know, that made life much more difficult. Clearly, they don't have the funds anymore to really investigate this, and for them to have pulled out was a bit serious for the field. Lots of other very good people working in this field, of course, much smaller biotechs and so on. However, I think as you get older, you reflect back on your career, and really we haven't succeeded in psychiatry the way we have in other disciplines, like in cancer treatments. Has absolutely been revolutionized in the last, for this is 40 years I've been doing this. Cardiovascular, you know, the treatment of so many other strokes has been pretty much revolutionized with new technology. And really in psychiatry, treatment options for people are still very limited. And in spite of all the amazing work that the drug companies I worked for, you know, the great science, the great molecules, nothing came into patients that really was significantly a huge advancement since the 1950s, since the discovery of the first antidepressant and the first antipsychotic, kind of by serendipity. There have, of course, been small advances, but nothing that's revolutionised psychiatry.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And Robin, here we are. Psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy is treating people where nothing else does, where, say, a third of people don't respond to antidepressants who desperately need help. For PTSD, there are at least a third of people who don't respond to the current treatment options. And many of the people I've met, the combat veterans, were those people who were not responding. And those people, for those people, they accessed psychedelic-assisted therapy themselves. And that's the shame of this, Robin, that
right. People
like that who fought for our country could not access this, the treatment that was going to save their lives when they're so severely traumatized because of their experiences in Afghanistan and other places, had to go to Holland or Peru and pay for themselves and access this treatment. And actually, the chap I met, one of the things that really changed me to give up the lab work, to give up all the work I'd done my whole career and to focus on psychedelic medicine with drug science with Manchester, was because of meeting people like this. Mm. And I met a combat veteran a paratrooper who'd served in Afghanistan and came back severely traumatized. And anything offered on the NHS was not helpful for him. And he was not able to get the help he needed here. So he took himself to Holland and did two doses of truffles, contain the magic mushroom psilocybin. Mm-hmm. And he came out healed, and he was in a hotel room with his girlfriend. And that's not how we would want this therapy to be delivered. A retreat is fine, but you would want to, to go to another country, but you would want to be seriously well supported by specialists. And he didn't have the money, he didn't have the luxury for that. And that is a terrible situation for us to be in. And I took a sabbatical to learn as much as I could about psychedelic assisted therapy. And I also met a cancer survivor who's a psychiatrist, who I believe you know, Robin. And she had a terminal cancer diagnosis at 29. And the, of course, huge existential anxiety and depression and fear. Her life would have been ended far too soon. And she felt she hadn't achieved anything much at that stage. So her story is, again, she went away from this country and did psilocybin and completely revolutionized how she felt about, the rest of her life. And it's an extraordinary what happened to her. She met people that she'd been treated with in the hospital with chemotherapy, and very sadly they had died. But they came to her because this is very much an altered state of consciousness and a sort of interaction with, people talk about interacting with other sort of beings. And they came to her in her experience and told her not to be frightened, that they would be there for her when it was her time, but this was not her time. And she did get into a treatment that happily worked for her. But she said that experience has completely lasted for her. And she has now, she's also changed her career to help other people in a similar circumstance to how she was. So as well as the trial data are wonderful, but to hear those personal stories,
absolutely,
that just completely changed everything for me. And that's why I want to do this research now. We did a study on combat veterans, because we really need to provide, I think as a scientist, we need to provide evidence how badly needed this is, this treatment is, to be as a treatment option. I'm not saying this is for everybody,
no,
but it must be available for people who need it.
Mm. Well, yes, and the thing that's so stunning about it is how remarkable it can be in terms of its efficiency, its effect. To be so quickly effective and so long lasting is just like, it's mega unusual in the world of medicine, isn't it? It's just like...
doesn't exist.
All right. I can imagine that after your long career, you're actually really excited to be doing this work at last, where you feel you're onto something which is really going to make a difference.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely, Robin. That's the whole point of everything I've done, really, was to provide patients with something that would work much better for them and people who don't respond. And the other thing about this is that it's a challenging experience, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
With all the support, it should be a hugely, people talk about it as being the most profound experience of their lives. But it's actually physiologically remarkably safe. Mm-hmm. And if you think you're taking a once or twice, maybe three times dose, separated by, you know, probably a week apart. And that's likely, because the effects are so long lasting, because the effects in the brain are they sort of resets the brain. This isn't a medicine you need to take every day or frequently at all.
Right.
Some people may need another top up, you know, in another 6 months or so on. But, and that's an extraordinary paradigm shift, because if you're on an antidepressant, antipsychotic, anticonvulsant, whatever, it's every day, and you have a very large side effect burden because of that. The side effects of some of these medicines are severe and significant for people. And this is something that completely avoids that. And these effects being so long-lasting is really remarkable, and it's exciting scientifically.
Yeah, I think it's important to point to how utterly unusual that is. I mean, this is classed as a drug, but actually it's a natural substance. It's a food, if you like. And of course, all the integrative practices which are based on foods, the effect is only positive. There aren't negative side effects. You only get healthier. And the same is true of this. It's just in a rather different arena, that it's the health of your mind, your consciousness, your psychology. So incredible, a great story. So for a lot of people who are listening, the whole arena has got little to do with health and wellness, and an awful lot to do with kind of illegal parties and teenagers exploring the boundaries of experience, or should I say recreational drugs, as they're known. So can you tell us how psychedelics got to be thought of as something that could help us in this meaningful way, and explain what we know about why and how they work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think back to the indigenous people.
Mm.
I think the anthropologists who have gone to Peru and, to the Amazon, and have spent time with the Shipibo people. One, you know, example of an indigenous population who uses these medicines, have a really good understanding of what an age-old tradition this is, and that the knowledge that indigenous people have of these plant medicines, and of course of thousands of plant medicines in the Amazon.
Right.
So we in the West can claim none of that.
Okay.
We can do our imaging studies, you know, and understand what circuits are being changed or affected in the brain, but we cannot claim any of the the extraordinary health benefits and of these medicines. So the indigenous people have known about it for years. I guess our ancestors used mushrooms and in their ceremonies. But of course it really wasn't until Hoffman synthesized LSD way back in 1938 that we started to bring this into modern science, if you like. Modern I guess we probably would go back to Arthur Hefter, actually, who isolated mescaline. So he was in the 1890s. So there are, of course, historical reports of isolating the active component from these plants, kind of before Hoffman. And the evidence was starting to accumulate. And I guess it was all the counterculture revolution, really, that shut the research down, because Timothy Leary and, you know, individuals who were keen for everyone to try, and the chap here that I forget his name, the chap who was making LSD in his farm in Wales. I mean, that's in the 70s. But there were many people who believed that this would be beneficial for mankind, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the Timothy Leary with people not wanting to fight in a Vietnam War was not what the American government wanted at all. No. And I, you know, so you can, there's sort of a lot of historical perspective as to why these drugs were made illegal. But of course, having a drug illegal does not stop anybody using it. And we know that the war on drugs has been an absolute catastrophic disaster for people. Mm. And many people have died who shouldn't die. And I mean, that is kind of a separate issue. But in terms of the harms caused by the different classes of drugs, so I work with David Nutt now, and of course, he's done a very detailed analysis of the harms to society and the harms to the user,
right,
of a range of drugs. And we shouldn't pretend that, you know, drugs are safe. They'd certainly be safer if there was a regulated market and you knew what you were buying. That would be much safer.
Right.
But, you know, alcohol really comes out top as causing most harm to society and most harm to the user. And we forget that people die of alcohol-related illnesses every single day.
Yeah.
And if we compare that to plant medicines, psilocybin, LSD, MDMA, even, you know, ecstasy made in the lab, you know, they're remarkably safe. Of course, no drug is without its risks, and the psychological effect is hugely challenging. And if you have a heart disturbance, there could be complications with taking these because of their pharmacology. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you look at the analysis, heroin is clearly harmful. It can cause respiratory depression. Cocaine can cause very significant heart problems. So when you look at the harms, there are harms to all drugs. But of course, there's a harm from paracetamol.
Right.
You know, there's a harm from taking any medicine.
Yeah. Interesting. So I just wanted to hop back to one of the things. When you started answering that, you were talking about this traditional use of these in society. And it's interesting to me that there wasn't just a medicinal use about these psychedelics, as they're actually a rite of passage in some societies, I understand. So they were actually seen as necessary for somebody to grow into a mature view of the world and in order to have a fulfilling adulthood. So that's very telling, really, about what it does for you as a substance.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And there is a lot of research going on now about connectedness to nature.
Mm.
And actually, the chap in Wales, that he, you know, he was an environmentalist. He wanted people to save the planet, really. You could see, you know, we're in an environmental catastrophe in this world, aren't we?
Mm.
So for people to really have a much deeper connection to nature. And of course, we all need that.
Mm,
every one of us needs a deeper connection.
Yeah, well, that's something on its own, is, as you say, it's having a lot of attention, a lot of research. And it's remarkable what they're finding out about the effects of a connection to nature. You know, you know, bird song actually is good for you. You know, just amazing things. So, yeah, we talk about that quite often and had some great guests on the show talking about that.
Well, Robin, the other thing, since I moved to the coast, I've been swimming in the sea every day.
Right.
And, of course, the cold water swimming is another hugely beneficial.
Yeah. So you're part of this drive to move some of the drugs from having a label of recreational to medical.
Yes.
And to do this requires evidence. So hence your trial. So what do we need to see happen in the UK to enable patients to access to this medicine?
We need to change the law. We need to change the mindset of the powers that be, and we need to change the law. So we to start as a simple change, we need to reschedule psilocybin. So we need to take it out of Schedule 1. I mean, the definition of a Schedule 1 drug is that it causes a great deal of harm and that it has no medicinal therapeutic benefit. So that none of that fits for psychedelics. And actually, there aren't many drugs in Schedule 1. Most drugs are in Schedule 2, like heroin, cocaine, amphetamine, ketamine, because they do have a medical benefit for certain patient groups. You know, we would be in big trouble without opiates for severe pain operations and hospitals and so on. So for anybody working in a university or in the NHS, we have an exemption for Schedule 2 drugs. So we don't need any special permission to store them, to use them, to get rid, you know, to destroy them. But when it comes to a Schedule 1 drug, we do. So we need the special license. It costs a lot of money. You need an awful lot of extra safety and security in your laboratory, which we have anyway. Well, our drug, you know, laboratories are full of dangerous chemicals.
Right.
And we're, you know, that's what universities and NHS do. So that would certainly enable a great deal more research to be done. But what I would like to see is the law change, as they did for cannabis. They changed the law and made it legal as a medicine. And that's exactly what we need to do for psilocybin, in my view.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with ZeroZilchZip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit ZeroZilchZip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so now let's home in on the study itself that I mentioned at the start. You're both involved in this. So, Rachel, maybe you tell us what the aim is of the trial and what you're hoping to demonstrate.
Okay, so I'll just give you a brief overview of the study first. So it's a qualitative piece of research. So that means I will be conducting interviews with people. And I will be interviewing people who have or have previously had a cancer diagnosis, but who have also experienced mental health issues because of that diagnosis. And the interviews, the aim is to explore, you know, their use of psilocybin, why they use it, their views on psilocybin and their views on the law and the scheduling. And also I will be asking them about the mental health symptoms, if they've tried prescribed antidepressants before or therapy, how that went for them, and then maybe why they have then come to the decision to use psilocybin. So that's what I'm going to be asking people about.
Right. And did you mention how many people you're hoping to study? Maybe you did, but I missed it.
No, I don't think I did, actually. So this is for my dissertation, for my master's, so it's not going to be the biggest piece of research because I am time limited, unfortunately. So I'm looking at around 10. We can do, you know, if we've got more, fabulous, we can do a bit more. So it'll be about, you know, 10, maybe 15 interviews if we get enough interest, because, well, the bigger the better, really. But like you said, well, like I said, even I'm time limited, so I can't unfortunately do an unlimited or huge number of interviews.
Right.
But Rachel, they will be quite in-depth interviews, won't they?
Yeah, so the interviews will be about an hour, and they're not, you know, I'm not going to be skirting around. I want in depth. And this is the whole point of qualitative research and the way we analyze qualitative research. We want in depth. We don't want surface level. We really need to understand what has motivated these individuals to use psilocybin. What have they tried before? Have they tried everything and nothing's worked? And that's why we really need to understand this, because and that kind of leads on to why this is important, because there is quite a big gap in the literature when it comes to qualitative research and psilocybin. As Joe said, there's a fair amount of clinical trials comparing antidepressants to psilocybin.
Okay.
But what we really don't have is a perspective from the people who take psilocybin. And if we want change, to bring about change, we need this full picture. And that includes understanding people's experiences. And so it's a really important part of, helping to encourage change.
So it's interesting because the experience in an awful lot of drug development, say, is that the experience of the patient is actually almost the last thing to be of any interest. You measure anything you like, but actually asking the person whether they thought it helped them or not doesn't seem to be very important. Yeah. But is it the case that in mental health issues, it's much more, there's much more interest in it? Is that, or is this your particular feeling to want to get the patient experience to capture it?
I think it's really important. It's kind of like there's no point having a drug. We could use antidepressants as an example. We know they work for some people, but they don't work for a lot of people, and they have really negative experiences. Or these antidepressants, they work, but this person is having the worst side effects or the worst experiences. Yeah. Then what's the, almost it's like, what's the point?
Yeah.
So to me personally, the experience of the individual, and I think Joe would probably agree, is so, so important. And that's kind of what I'm going to be digging deep into in my research. And that's what we don't really, we know anecdotally that as people who take psilocybin, it's been a good experience, but we don't know enough.
Right.
We need to know more.
Yeah. I think in psychiatry, their drug development in general, there probably hasn't been, there really hasn't been enough patient focus and patient emphasis. But in the psychedelic field, I think there is more. But in terms of systematic qualitative, there are a lot of reports, case reports and so on. But in the qualitative systematic analysis, bringing out different themes that we did for the combat veteran study, there really is very little of that around, and we really need to much better understand patient motives, their experiences, and the need or otherwise for psilocybin. We certainly know we absolutely need alternative treatments for people.
Right. So best case scenario, this comes out, your trial demonstrates it's a fantastic success, that people think there's nothing like it, nothing has helped them in the way that psilocybin does, and the effects have been brilliant. How much effect is that result that of your trial going to have out in the world there?
Well, we will make sure it has maximum impact. So we will publish it in the Drug Science Journal, Drug Science Policy and Law, and that's where we're publishing the Combat Veteran Study.
Okay.
And actually, we did a study, Robin, on Schedule 1 restrictions to research, a qualitative study, because I had so much trouble.
Right.
I thought, well, let me ask my colleagues and let's do it in a systematic, qualitative, a way, proper analysis. And we found out that there are haves and have-nots, and lots of clever people will not do this research because they cannot go through all the hoops. They're not supported. Mm. They don't have the money. And that has been useful. as part of, you know, changing or trying to change government policy. And in fact, the government have just asked for a review on drug policy, and this is one thing that they are interested in. So, and I will be giving evidence to a select committee week after next. So that it's part of it, and it's a very important part to get the perspective of what is happening in reality, but to do it in a systematic way. And this interviewing and with the thematic analysis that Rachel and Verity will do is exactly what is required for that.
Interesting. Okay, so we've got a little bit of time left, and I just wanted to tease out a bit more. You've alluded to what's going on when people take these drugs, what effect that is having on them, why it might be having such a radical effect on their worldview. Can we just go into that a little bit more? You talked about the sort of their ego sort of being in abatement, if you like, for a period, yeah. And the effect that has. Could you just describe more what's going on?
It's really, really interesting, Robert. And I think only recently with the neuroimaging studies have we really been able to see into the brain, really, and what is going on. But sort of simplistically, because actually that's how I understand it, the brain is divided into a series of networks. And a lot of your brain is devoted to sort of control and top-down control of your behavior. And that really involves your ego and you what you have to do, what you have to function. And that's called the default mode network. And that's cortex down. So we're sort of the top down, you know, the bit of the brain that does all the sort of complicated abstract thinking and kind of keeps you in check, if you like. And actually that we see that the activity in that network is reduced, massively reduced by the psilocybin. And we kind of know how that works because of the pharmacology, because they work on this, the selective serotonin system in the brain. And what that does, the knock-on effect of that is to enable other circuits to communicate with each other that are kind of disabled from doing that in order to keep us, you know, doing functioning and kind of going about our daily business. But that really enables people to completely change their viewpoint of the world and their relationship to the world, which for so many people is enormously beneficial because it takes you away and you sort of, you become much more connected. It's kind of a little bit hard to explain. But it's like the brain kind of gets into a kind of a groove, a kind of a set pattern of functioning and thinking that can become quite destructive for people. Certainly in depression, it's a lot of negative rumination and thought processes. And that is a sort of self-perpetuating process within the brain and, of course, within your feelings and your behaviours and your attitude towards yourself, you know, the not having self-compassion and that kind of right. behaviour pattern. And what the psychedelic does, it resets all that. And if you talk to the combat veterans, they're able to see that the things that have happened to them and that they have done are not their fault. So they believed that what they were doing was right and they were following orders. That's kind of simplified, but that's the impression I've got from speaking to those people. And lots of serious depression comes from childhood trauma, and it really enables people to face that and to deal with it in a way that is kind of less blameful to themselves. They've kind of blamed themselves and got into this rumination and groove of it, and it resets that. But also we have this neuroplasticity effect because of the pharmacology, and that then some of these effects become very long lasting. And Robin, you know what that is? That is healing from trauma.
Absolutely.
And we in psychiatry, we don't heal people. We manage their symptoms.
Right.
And this, the another revolution of this is that it heals people and it enables them to to live much better lives, and you know, removes the all that mental distress.
Yeah, so it's like opening a window in a way that you know, for somebody who's been has got completely caught up in their own experience and their own view, if you like, which was generated by trauma. All sorts of things have created, say, a worldview which is very fearful. And therefore they go around, they may look like a normal person doing stuff, but actually their attention is all the time on keeping control and keeping safe. And yes. It allows them to let go of that whole thing and just have a look around, you know, and see what's actually going on, and thereby understand their world in a different way.
I mean, that's a brilliant way to describe it. Let go, right. And have a different perspective, well, which is so positive for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't it amazing that there should be a substance out there that can be so beneficial in this way? This is the extraordinary thing about the world of nature, is there are these things out there which just seem to work for us. I mean, funnily enough, mushrooms, of course, have got loads on offer for us. Apart from this, you know, this is just one thing they can do. Extraordinary what they have.
Mushrooms is a wonderful species.
Yes.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yes. Okay, well, look, we're going to have to wrap it up. Just quickly, do you want to both of you say how you anticipate attitudes to psychedelics developing in the next decade?
They are already changing, Robin. We did a YouGov survey of the acceptability of psilocybin across the British public. I'd never done one before. I didn't realise that it was completely included all demographics, Northern Ireland as well, all, you know, all over the UK. And when we asked people about, was it acceptable for people to access psilocybin for combat veterans, they were positive about that. You know, we'd something like 60% of people wanted that to happen. But actually, for compassionate access, for people with a life-threatening diagnosis, it was massively increased, even above the trauma of combat veterans, and it was up to closer to 70%. And these are people very conservative. These are people who will have been grown up believing that drugs are bad. Mm-hmm. So, and actually, the acceptability in general of psilocybin. So I'm extremely positive. The public and people I speak to in the street, you know, as you can imagine, I talk about this a lot to anybody who'll listen.
Yeah.
People are very interested and, you know, supportive. So that's changing, but we need to change people who can change the law. So it's government officials. We really need to change their attitude to drugs, to this.
Yeah. Do you want to add to that, Rachel?
I think with people's knowledge base growing about psilocybin, if they can understand it more, then that's when, you know, they will think it's more acceptable. I think it's when people don't understand what it is, that's when they're like, well, I'm not sure. They've just heard that it's, you know, a psychedelic drug, don't really know what it is. And that is hopefully how our research, it, you know, will not only hopefully help towards policy change, also towards knowledge, just like the everyday person's knowledge about psilocybin, what it is, what it can do. And I think that's important as well. We obviously, we want policy change, but I think the general public having knowledge about these kinds of drugs, or psilocybin, is really important as well. And it's only recently, actually, I've seen, you know, in newspapers, I've seen a good few articles recently about psilocybin.
Yeah.
So, it is coming into the public sphere a lot more.
It is, yeah. Okay, well, we're going to have to end it there. Fascinating chat. Thank you both so much. Really interesting territory for our listeners who are, people who are concerned with cancer in some way, but actually for anybody, really.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you. It's been a
real pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you again.
Let's hope that governments can be persuaded to change the law around psychedelics as medicines very soon. As with a rapidly growing mental health crisis we're facing, we are in desperate need of some solutions that actually work. If you're someone who meets the description Rachel gave for eligibility for their study and are interested to consider participation, please email radio@yestolife.org.uk and we'll pass on your details. Lastly, a quick reminder of our online panel forum on June the 11th, Natural Ways to Deal with Common Side Effects. This is going to be a goldmine of practical, helpful ways to support yourself through cancer, and it's only £15 to attend and to benefit from the summary advice of no less than 9 experts. To book, go to yestolife.org.uk and click the Find Out More button on the rolling banner at the top of the homepage. Thanks as always for listening. If you have suggestions for the show, guests you'd like to hear more from, experts who've not been on the show before, topics to explore, well then please do let me know by going to yestolife.org.uk, clicking the link to the radio show page, and there you'll find a link to let me know your suggestions. I'll be back again next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio, so please do join me again. Goodbye. Thank you.